This is Audible.
Audible Original Publishing presents Out of Spite, Out of Mind, Book 5 of the Magic 2.0 series. Written by Scott Meyer. Performed by Luke Daniels.
1. Britt the Elder's house exuded the sort of serenity that's only possible in a home when nobody's there to enjoy it. A small amount of light from the outside filtered in through the blinds, partially illuminating an interior that contained just enough furniture, mementos, and objets d'art to qualify as deliberately austere, rather than just empty. In the midst of all this stillness and silence, Britt the Elder materialized. Other magic users would simply pop into existence, or appear after an animation and sound effect intended to impress any witnesses, but which usually just resembled the beaming-in special effect from Star Trek. Britt the Elder had spent a great deal of time perfecting her own materialization macro to be subtle yet noticeable. The result was that she appeared to slip elegantly into existence, like a silver spoon rising to the surface of a bone china bowl full of vichyssoise. She appeared standing straight and tall, as was her habit. She glanced around to verify that she was alone, following which her entire skeleton seemed to sag, and she said one word. "Shit." She said the word slowly, as if it had 7 syllables, or she was trying to communicate the concept of shit to someone who spoke a different language. Without bothering to turn on any lights, she staggered 2 steps to a nearby chaise longue. It was meant to be gracefully laid upon, preferably while reading a design magazine. Instead, Britt the Elder planted her rear end directly in the chaise's middle and slumped forward as if she were sitting on a park bench holding a plastic bottle of vodka wrapped in a paper bag. She often returned from her visits with Britt the Younger feeling a bit wrung out. She disliked confrontations to begin with, and Britt the Younger was almost always angry with her. Britt the Elder found it all particularly upsetting, because she had been Britt the Younger long ago, and watching her younger self lose her temper made Britt the Elder remember those emotions from when she lived them, and she was angry with Britt the Elder, who she had disliked intensely at the time, and who she herself now was. The experience usually left her feeling a unique combination of self-directed anger, remorse, confusion, and more self-directed anger coming from the opposite direction. It was always bad, but this time it was much worse. "What's happening?" she thought. "What am I going to do?" Just having those thoughts was enough to make Britt the Elder panic, but she fought it down, forcing herself to breathe slowly and think logically. She fidgeted with her right foot, pressing the tips of her toes against the floor. "Okay," she thought. "Calm down. Think it through. I remember clearly back when I was Britt the Younger, the wizards in Ledchurch made Kluge an offer that would help his gang work together with them. I remember Kluge turning down the deal Philip offered him. But Britt the Younger says he took the deal, and she's Britt the Younger right now, so you'd think the memory's a lot fresher for her. Where does that leave me? For the first time I can recall, something has happened differently from how I remember it happening. How is this possible?" She could see 3 options. The 2 most appealing possibilities were that she had misremembered, or that Britt the Younger was wrong. Either of those options amounted to a mistake on her part. The only difference was when she messed up, when she was Britt the Younger or when she was Britt the Elder. She hated making mistakes, but it was far preferable to the implications of the 3rd possibility, that there was some error in the code. The error could be in her code, which might lead to her death, or the error could be in the code that generated the entire known universe, which might lead to the destruction of everything. She figured an error was bad news for her either way. A 4th option occurred to her, but she liked it even less. It was possible that her memories were not tied to Britt the Younger's experiences. All of the beliefs that had governed her every action for the last several decades of her life might have been completely misguided, causing her to be a hateful monster to Britt the Younger for no real reason at all. Of those options, the easiest option to verify was that she had misremembered, so she decided to start with that. Britt the Elder rose from the chair and walked from her sleek and modern great room down a tasteful hall and into her minimal functional office and workshop, where a walnut desk supported her computer, an original one-piece Macintosh. The computer's plastic case had long ago faded from its original stylish gray tones to a dingy yellow, not dissimilar to the color of a dehydrated man's urine. It was a common problem with the plastics used in the cases of the early Macintosh computers. Once, Britt had been amazed that Steve Jobs would allow a product to ship with such an obvious aesthetic flaw, but in time she realized that Steve Jobs didn't consider anything that would cause a customer to want to buy a newer computer a flaw. Britt the Elder sat down in front of the computer, absent-mindedly rubbing the toes of her shoes together as she wiggled the mouse back and forth to rid the screen of flying toasters. She navigated through the file structure to the folder that held her journals. Her many, many journals. She had started keeping a daily record of her thoughts, hopes, dreams, and actions when she was a teenager, back when that meant trying to keep track of which member of her current favorite boy band was dreamiest. She found that keeping the journals helped her make sense of a day's events and organize her thoughts and ideas, so she kept it up, switching later to the computer from the paper notebooks. The journals were a daily catalog of her irritating interactions with her future self, but also held the day-to-day account of every other time traveler she'd met, every major event she'd witnessed, and her feelings about all of them. There was a weird stretch of nearly a decade where the notes got spotty, but she wasn't quite to that bit yet. Some of the entries contained notes so detailed as to describe people's actual physical movements and timing information down to the second. It was an invaluable record, and Britt the Elder used it to appear nearly omniscient. Reading the labels on the grid of file folders, Britt scanned all the major events of her life, her discovery of the file, her notes from her experiments where she learned how to fly, teleport, time travel, stop the aging process, and do any number of other things that others thought of as magic. Her account of when she decided to travel back in time to find Atlantis, or if Atlantis didn't exist, build it herself. And the angry screed she wrote when she traveled back, found Atlantis waiting for, and discovered that the city hadn't existed until a future version of herself went even further back in time, built the whole place herself, then waited around for her younger self to arrive. She poked through the scores of folders that documented the years she spent as Britt the Younger, living in Atlantis, in the shadow of her future self, who the whole city looked to as a leader simply because she'd gotten there first, even if she had done it much later. She'd stopped writing the journals when she became Britt the Elder. She didn't want Britt the Much Elder reading her thoughts, and was certain that she would, because that's exactly what she herself was doing to Britt the Younger. Of course, she told Britt the Younger that she hadn't looked at the journals in years. That was the only reason Britt the Younger still kept them. In retrospect, she was more than a little embarrassed that she had believed such an obvious lie when Britt the Elder told it to her all those decades ago. Britt searched through the folder for the current decade, then the year, then the month, and pulled up the MacWrite file for the current day. She waited as the antique computer churned through the daunting task of opening a single-page text file. "Of course I just misremembered it," she thought. "I got caught up helping tend to the wounded from the dragon attack, so I didn't bother to read the journal this morning. It figures that this'd be one of those rare times when I misremember something. I'll just double-check. The journal will confirm what Britt the Younger said, and I'll laugh this off." The screen filled with menu headings, a ruler, and Britt's recollections from this very day when she'd lived it the first time, more than 100 years earlier. Britt leaned in close to the screen, silently absorbing the words, clicking intermittently to scroll downward. She blinked, rubbed her eyes, and leaned in closer. "Philip explained the offer to Kluge. He was resistant. Philip explained that Kluge and his gang wouldn't be harmed in any way, but that we would want them to try their hardest to kill us. But Kluge wanted no part of it. We even described the fake rideable dragons they'd get to use, but his distrust just runs too deep. Maybe someday we'll win him over, but it won't be any time soon." Britt the Elder leaned back in her chair, staring at the computer's tiny built-in monitor. She kicked her shoes off as she continued reading, hoping to find something about Kluge changing his mind. Just a few minutes ago, the journal continued, Britt the Elder came over. I told her that Kluge had declined the offer. She said she already knew that he would come around eventually, and congratulated me on how well my friends and I had handled the situation. She was trying to be nice, but I wish she wouldn't bother if she doesn't really mean it. Britt the Elder shook her head. Even when I'm nice to her, she assumes it's insincere, the little snot. Her memories matched the historical record, but did not match the events that had actually happened. Back when she was Britt the Younger, she had experienced the event of Kluge refusing Philip's offer. She then wrote about Kluge refusing Philip's offer in her journal, which proved that it happened the way she remembered it. Except that it appeared that the opposite was true. Kluge accepted the offer. Which was not possible. Events had not unfolded in the way that the events had unfolded, which was of course a paradox. She could only conclude that either there was something wrong with the program of the universe, or the last 100 years of the journal's perfectly matching observed events had been a long series of coincidences. She found one of those answers a lot more likely than the other. A glitch is the simplest answer. Of course, glitches can cause further glitches, then cascade failures, then system crashes. Occam's razor may have just slit the world's throat. Britt the Elder sat frowning for over a minute before coming to the decision that this was a problem she couldn't frown away. She couldn't rely on her memories or her notes about what would happen tomorrow. For the first time in a very, very long time, she didn't know what was about to happen. I'm completely in the dark. I don't know what to do. Well, that's not true. I have a good idea what the logical next move is. It's just that being in the dark might be preferable. She sat in silence for a moment, trying to puzzle out some simple solution that didn't involve doing anything she loathed. Bracing herself against the floor with one foot, she drew the other one up into her lap and absent-mindedly scratched at her toes. This all seems bad. But what is it so far? One anomaly that only I noticed. It's probably just some little hiccup. I have no reason to believe anything else is wrong. What is going on with my feet? They don't itch exactly, but still. She looked down at her foot, illuminated by the gray light from the monitor, and let out a small, strangled shriek. She lifted up her right foot to get a better look. At first, it looked perfectly normal, but then, without warning, it changed to a crude approximation of a human foot, constructed entirely out of triangles the color of her skin. Her foot remained in this unnatural condition for a couple of seconds, then changed back to her ordinary regular foot. She stared at it for a long time, watching it transform back and forth at random between flesh and bone and living polygons. She only looked away when she realized that the toes of her other foot felt odd as well. She lowered her right foot and lifted and stared at her left foot, seeing that it was doing the same bizarre thing. She slouched down in the chair, gripped the seat base for support, and put both feet up on her desk. She stared at them for a moment. Then, very slowly, as if the word had 14 syllables, said, "Shh." 2. Almost 24 hours later, evening was falling over Atlantis like a freshly laundered bedsheet, descending over a bare mattress just before getting its hospital corners tucked in. The citizens walked home after their day's activities. Merchants either packed up their goods or shouted to anyone who would listen that they were selling them at a loss to keep from having to carry them away. The light from the sunset reflected off the silver sequins of Martin's robe and wizard hat and the silver bust of Santo on the head of his staff, projecting a million pinpricks of light that danced and bobbed on the walls, the ground, and Gwen, who walked beside him. Her robe and hat were made of a subdued tan material, but caught the eye just as much as Martin's, as they were expertly tailored and draped to Gwen's petite frame.
"Why are we walking again?"
Martin asked.
Gwen said, "You know why. We discussed it, and agreed that it was a terrible idea to ever teleport to Gary's."
"We agreed it's a terrible idea to teleport to Gary's if he knows we're coming," Martin corrected her. "We might as well ask him to set up a nasty surprise for us. And I know that we're flying from Britt and Phillips to Gary's place. I just don't understand why you wanted to walk from your place to Britt's.
Oh, that. For fun.
Fun? We can fly and teleport, and walking across town is your idea of fun?
Gwen laughed and took Martin's arm.
Look around you. What's the point of living somewhere beautiful if you always teleport past it, or fly through too quickly to enjoy it?
Martin looked at his surroundings and admitted she had a point. One of the advantages to the fact that Atlantis was built inside an immense bowl floating rim-deep in the Mediterranean was that when one looked out across the bowl, almost the entire city was visible from any one spot. The narrow streets formed concentric rings, growing both larger and higher as they radiated outward, built on the roofs of the buildings along the streets below, like terraces cut into a hillside. This encouraged the sorceresses in charge to make sure that any proposed new building, garden, or pathway met certain aesthetic standards. Martin saw a vista of minimalist glass buildings, beautifully manicured green spaces, and palm trees rustling gently in the Mediterranean breeze, all tinted pink by the distant sunset.
Okay, I see your point. But why don't you ever want to walk anywhere when we're at my place?
Because your place is in medieval London. The streets are paved with mud and people poop out their windows.
The second of those statements sort of contradicts the first. I guess that means you'll want to live in Atlantis then.
I live in Atlantis now.
I mean, later. When we live together.
We've talked about this, Martin. I'm not interested in living together out of wedlock.
I know that, Gwen. That's not what I'm saying.
Gwen stopped walking and stared at him.
Martin Banks, are you asking me to marry you?
Oh, Lord, no.
Gwen said nothing.
Martin said, let me rephrase that.
Gwen's eyes narrowed.
Please do.
What I mean is, I wouldn't propose like this, just casually dropping it in conversation. I'd make a much bigger deal out of it.
Good.
Yeah. And I don't know that we're ready for that quite yet. But I do think I'd like to be married to you eventually.
Again, Gwen said,
good.
Martin took a step closer to Gwen and lowered his voice a bit.
What do you think? I think it's good to know where you stand.
And where do you stand, Gwen?
Do you think you'd like to be married to me eventually? Gwen resumed walking at a brisk pace.
I'd rather not discuss it.
Just tell me how you feel. Your gut instinct.
My gut instinct is that that would be discussing it, which I've already told you I'd rather not do.
You don't want to marry me!
I didn't say that. Maybe I think I might want to marry you, but I worry I could change my mind later and I don't want to commit myself right now.
Is that any better?
I'm not saying it is. I'm not even saying that's how I feel. I'm just saying that it's a different reason.
Martin chewed on this for a moment, following Gwen as she double-timed it through Atlantis. Britt the Younger's apartment was in sight now, and it seemed Gwen couldn't get there soon enough. Finally, he said,
so, either you think you might want to marry me, but you fear that you'll change your mind, or you don't want to marry me, but you want to keep the option open in case you decide you can't do better. I'm going to be bummed either way, aren't I?
Gwen remained silent.
Which, I'm sure, is why you didn't want to discuss it.
Gwen stopped at the door to Britt the Younger's apartment and rang the bell. She glanced over at Martin.
A smart woman keeps her options open.
Martin said,
all I've done is told you how I feel. My options are just as open as yours, and I'm just as likely to change my mind as you are.
Britt the Younger opened the door. She pushed her glasses higher up on her nose and smiled.
Gwen, Martin, I'm so glad you stopped by.
Martin and Gwen stopped looking at each other and instead focused on Britt, attempting unsuccessfully to hide the emotions their conversation had just dredged up. Britt said,
I think I'm glad you stopped by. Come in.
Britt the Younger's front door entered directly into the main room of her apartment, a spacious, high-ceilinged space, one whole wall of which was a curved window that looked out into the dark blue depths beneath the surface of the ocean. Along the back wall there was a table and chairs, as well as a large kitchen where her domestic servant and close friend Nick was puttering away on some unidentifiable project. The other wall featured two incongruously rustic wooden doors. Gwen entered first and made a beeline for the long, low couch. She sat at one end and pressed herself into the armrest, giving the impression that no matter where on the couch Martin chose to sit, she wanted to be as far from him as possible. Martin didn't make any effort to sit down, either on the couch or any of the other chairs. Instead, he walked steadily toward the two wooden doors set into the wall.
"Thanks for having us," he muttered as he walked past Britt. "Where's Philip?"
Britt said.
"In his rec room."
"Would you like anything? I could have Nick,"
Martin mumbled. "No, I'm good,"
and went through the door on the left. He emerged from the door, thousands of miles and thousands of years away. Physically, the door should have led into Britt's bedroom closet, but both of the wooden doors were enchanted, programmed to act as portals from Britt's home in the Bronze Age Mediterranean to Philip's two properties in Ledchurch, a town in medieval England. The door Martin chose led to the attic above Philip's office and workspace. Philip had filled this attic with all of his favorite things from his original time. Being a product of the mid-1980s, that meant a lot of white leather and neon lights. At the far end of the room, Philip's pristine white Pontiac Fiero occupied a place of honor. Through speakers the size of large tombstones, Sting advised that if Martin loved somebody, he should set them free. Martin walked to the bar, where an iPod he'd given Philip as a gift was wired into Philip's high-end 1985 rack-mounted stereo system through an old-school cassette adapter. One of the advantages of having a friend who was from a time 30 years prior to his own was that Martin could give him wildly outdated technology, then laugh inwardly when it blew Philip's mind. Without asking permission, Martin pressed the cassette player's stop button, ending the song with a resounding ka-chunk. Philip stood with his back to the room wearing no shoes, his sky-blue robe hanging open like a dressing gown, and his wizard hat crammed half into one of the pockets. He hunched over his vintage arcade game, a full-sized cabinet labeled Gorf. His staff leaned against the wall next to the cabinet. Martin stood beside Philip, his body canted at a slight angle, looking down at the screen as he had since his early adolescence whenever a friend was playing an arcade video game. A ship maneuvered around the bottom of the screen, shooting up through a curved shield at an orderly formation of spacecraft, which drizzled down return fire. Martin shook his head.
"Isn't this just a rip-off of Space Invaders?"
Philip said,
"No. The beauty of Gorf is that it isn't just one game. It's made up of several different games. It's a rip-off of Space Invaders, followed by a rip-off of Galaxian, followed by a rip-off of Tempest, topped off with a second slightly different Space Invaders rip-off."
"Ah, I see. I didn't know that. I've never made it past the first level."
"Too difficult?" Philip asked.
"Too boring."
They heard a rapid knocking at the door, forceful enough that it was not so much a request for permission to enter as a warning that entry was imminent. The door back to Britt's apartment creaked open and Nick leaned in.
"Can I offer you a cold drink? Maybe a quick bite to eat?"
Martin shook his head.
"Nothing for me, thanks."
Philip kept his eyes glued to the game and his hands on the controls, but said,
"Yes, it's kind of you to offer, but we'll all be leaving pretty soon, I should think."
"I suspected as much, but if you change your minds, the offer stands."
"You take awfully good care of us, Nick,"
Philip said, most of his brain still preoccupied with shooting fictional invaders from what might be called space.
"That's my job."
"You do it well. If there's anything I can ever do to make your job easier for you, I hope you'll tell me."
Nick said,
"Thank you, Philip, I will,"
and withdrew back into Britt's apartment and closed the door behind him. Philip said,
"That man is a treasure. I'd be lost without him."
Martin smiled.
"Not lost, just hungry and living in squalor."
Philip's eyes darted up to Martin for a second, then back to the game.
"I don't think that's quite accurate."
"I knew you before Nick came into the picture. It's accurate."
Philip continued slamming the joystick back and forth and pounding on the fire button.
"You're in a mood. What's wrong?"
Martin groaned.
"You and Gwen are fighting."
"Again?"
"And you said something stupid."
"I sort of accidentally proposed."
Philip laughed.
"That's a yes. I take it her response was less than enthusiastic."
"She didn't answer."
"She said nothing?"
"No, she said that she wasn't going to answer."
"Ouch."
Philip let go of the joystick, allowing his final spacecraft to be destroyed. Martin watched the animation and heard the burst of static from the speaker that signified the spacecraft exploding and its entire crew perishing in the vacuum of space. Philip stroked his short brown beard as he turned to face Martin.
Look at it this way. You and Gwen are meant to be,
Martin smiled.
Or,
Philip continued,
you're not. If you're not, there's nothing you can do to change that.
Martin scowled at Philip.
That doesn't make me feel any better.
It wasn't meant to. You're fighting with the woman you love. You're going to feel awful. For me to try to change that would be counterproductive.
Philip, have I ever told you what a good friend you are?
No, I don't believe you have.
Martin said, yep, that's not by accident. We can't all be as happy as you with your drama-free relationship. You're lucky.
I am very happy and lucky, but Britt and I both put a lot of work into avoiding drama. She's the most important person in my life. Keeping her happy is well worth all the effort I put in, and more. If I keep her happy, she'll stick around, and that will keep me happy.
That's fine for you, but what if you were in a relationship with someone who wasn't putting in the effort?
Martin, you're my best friend and one of my favorite people. But if you think being in a relationship with you hasn't required effort on Gwen's part, you haven't been paying attention.
Martin opened his mouth to respond, but stopped when both men heard a distant knocking from downstairs.
You expecting anyone? Martin asked.
No, I'd better see who it is.
Philip started down the stairs, then stopped, bent down, and picked up a pair of canvas high tops decorated with Union Jacks, before continuing on his way, sliding a bit in his socks. Martin followed close behind. Philip would have been more inclined to just let an unexpected visitor knock or shout at them to come back during business hours, but the last time someone came calling unexpectedly at his office door, it had been to announce that the town was under attack by dragons. He was disinclined to ignore the knocking now. Martin followed as he walked down the stairs and through the séance room, where a small table and a crystal ball disguised Philip's Commodore 64 computer. They passed through a beaded curtain into the front room, where walls full of small dusty shelves held countless small dusty bottles containing old dusty specimens or powders, which in many cases was just old dust. Philip opened the front door, but nobody was waiting outside. He and Martin looked out on one of Ledchurch's many dirt roads, lined with buildings made of grayish-beige stones, wooden beams, off-white plaster, and thatched roofs. It had often occurred to Martin that here in medieval England, before the invention of advanced paints and dyes, everything was essentially dirt-colored. This was lucky, as it helped hide the dirt with which everything was covered, because advanced detergents hadn't been invented either. Philip shrugged and started to close the door, but Martin stopped him, leaning outside. He looked to the right and saw nothing of interest, just Ledchurch at dusk. He looked to the left and saw a group of kids, one of whom was carrying away a rectangular package about the size of a hardbound book, carefully wrapped in shiny red paper. The kids were giggling quietly as if trying to contain their amusement. One of them looked back furtively at Philip's door, and when he saw Martin, quickly looked away, shushing his giggling friends.
Hey! Martin shouted. Did you see anybody knock on this door?
The boy carrying the package said,
No, sir.
Then he and his friends darted around a corner and out of sight.
Those kids just totally ripped you off, Martin said.
You think?
Philip leaned against his counter and pulled one of the canvas Union Jack high tops onto his foot.
More likely they just knocked on my door as they walked by as a laugh.
I'd bet anything that whatever was in that package was for you.
Oh, well, whatever it was, I'm sure they needed more.
What if it was something nasty, some kind of practical joke or something?
Then it would serve them right for stealing. Even if it was for me, I'm not going to go chasing them down for it. Whatever it was, bad for the image.
Martin cast one last rueful look in the direction the boys had fled and started to pull the door closed. His gaze swept across the street and caught a glimpse of a shadowy figure across the way, lurking in the gap between a timber and plaster building and a thatched hut. The lurker was adult-sized and seemed to be built like a fairly husky male, but it was hard to tell anything beyond that, as he wore a rough brown full-length cloak with a large hood pulled over his head. He seemed to be looking in the same direction Martin had been, the direction the roving gang of untrustworthy youths had gone. The hood's subtle movement gave Martin the impression that the person inside was shaking his head. The hood twisted around, and while Martin couldn't see the person's eyes or any of their face, the way it stopped moving abruptly while pointed directly at Philip's door left Martin with a distinct impression that the robe's owner had noticed Martin noticing them.
"Hey!"
Martin shouted.
"What's your deal?"
The figure jolted, having either been startled or suffering a full-body spasm, then darted around behind the building out of Martin's sight. Philip finished tying his shoes and stood, testing his weight on each foot to judge if he had tied them tightly enough.
"Martin, you're far too young to enter the yelling at young punks phase of your adulthood."
"What? No, I'm not yelling at the punks. They're long gone. No, there was someone else."
"Where?"
Martin pointed to a gap between two buildings across the street.
"He took off too, whoever he was."
Philip looked where the person had been, as if the size of the empty space they'd left would help Philip identify him.
"What did he look like?"
"I don't know," Martin said. "He was wearing a big heavy cloak with a hood. All I saw inside the hood was darkness."
"So, a Jawa. You saw a Jawa."
"No, it wasn't a Jawa."
"Are you sure? Were they trying to sell any used droids? Always check the motivator."
"It wasn't a Jawa. Jawas don't exist, and if they did, they wouldn't be in medieval England." "Wrong... I don't know, what do you call it? The wrong surroundings. The wrong context."
"Milieu,"
Philip said. Martin scowled.
"Yeah, that. The wrong... that. Besides, Jawas were little and had glowing eyes. This guy was guy-sized, and I didn't see any glowing eyes."
"Then maybe it was Orko. He'd be a better fit for a medieval setting. You know Orko from He-Man?"
"Yes, I am familiar with Orko,"
Martin said, more than a little indignant.
"And again, Orko was small and had glowing eyes, and he flew. He didn't even wear a hood. Orko had a pointy hat."
"Oh, yeah."
Philip pulled his wizard hat from his pocket and placed it on his head.
"He was a silly-looking little git."
Both Martin and Philip heard the beaded curtain behind them rustle. They turned to see Britt the Younger and Gwen standing behind them. Britt the Younger handed Philip his wizard staff, a long, knurled branch of wood with a small glass vial full of red liquid fastened to its head.
"What's going on?"
"Nothing,"
Martin replied. Philip said,
"Martin thinks he saw Jawa."
Britt and Gwen both asked, "Where?"
Martin said, "It wasn't a Jawa. Just someone dressed like one, and it doesn't matter. Whoever it was, they're gone now. We should go."
Philip pointed across the street.
"Over there, between those two buildings."
Britt and Gwen stepped outside and looked across the street. Britt said,
"I don't see anybody."
"Me neither,"
Gwen agreed.
"Of course not,"
Martin said, following the ladies outside.
"Like I said, they're gone now."
Gwen squinted at him.
"Then why did you want us to look for them?"
"I didn't!"
Britt rolled her eyes.
"Then why did you bring it up?"
Martin could see what was going on. Gwen was irritated with him, and Britt was Gwen's best friend, so now they were a unified front against him. Martin turned and looked at Philip. Philip looked at Martin, his best friend, then at Britt the Younger, the woman in his life, then at Gwen, the best friend of the woman in his life. Philip did some quick mental calculations, then stepped slightly closer to Britt and Gwen and frowned at Martin. Martin sighed.
"Can we just go?"
Gwen said,
"After you."
Martin pointed his staff upward and lifted into the air, followed by Philip, Britt the Younger, and finally Gwen. 3. Agent Miller sat with his left elbow hanging out the car window, right fingers drumming on the steering wheel. His eyes shifted focus at regular intervals between the building across the street he was assigned to watch and the car's rearview mirror, which he decided on his own to also keep an eye on. The car had been backed into a diagonal parking space. This had seemed like a lucky break at first, as it gave the agents an inconspicuous place to park with a clear view of their subject. Miller now realized that it left the rear of their car vulnerable to anyone walking down the sidewalk, as he and his partner concentrated on their assignment, watching the luxurious Rothschild building. Agent Murphy sat in the passenger seat, poking at the trackpad of his laptop.
You want to roll that window up? It's freezing!
Miller growled.
I'd love to close the window, but if I do, the windshield fogs up. Not that you'd know it, staring at your computer while I watch the subject.
The file's out there somewhere, Miller. We just have to find it again. And at least the laptop's generating a little bit of heat. You can roll the window up a little, then the window wouldn't fog all the way up. And we'd still be able to see the luxurious Rothschild building.
Yes, Murph, but just rolling the window part of the way up won't make it any warmer in here, will it? And you don't have to call it luxurious every time you mention it.
That's the name of the building, Miller. The luxurious Rothschild building. That's what it says on the sign. That's what it says on Google Maps. That's what the building's called.
Yeah, well, you can just say the Rothschild building. I'll know what you mean. Who puts luxurious in the name of a building anyway? What the hell even is that?
Murphy shrugged.
I don't know. It makes sure you know the building's luxurious. It's probably good marketing. Or maybe the guy the building was named after was called Luxurious Rothschild.
Sounds like a pimp.
We're in Reno. I'm sure a lot of the buildings are owned by pimps.
Miller glanced at the side mirror. He saw a smattering of tourists on the sidewalk for a moment before it was all eclipsed by the midsection of a young man in jeans, a denim jacket, and a plaid flannel shirt approaching with a thick stack of flyers in his hands. Miller groaned and pulled his arm back inside. The young man stooped down to greet Miller eye to eye. When he exhaled, the plume of his condensed breath extended into the car. He smiled and pushed one of his flyers into Miller's open window.
Hey, sir, if you and your friend are looking for something to do later, why not?
Miller stared into the young man's eyes, but said nothing as he cranked the window shut. The young man stopped talking, but kept the flyer extended so that it got caught in the window. As the glass extended into its slot at the top of the frame, the flyer bent and flapped downward as the young man stood up and walked back to the sidewalk behind the car. Miller mumbled,
"How they found a rental car with crank windows in this day and age, I'll never know."
Agent Murphy asked,
"What's the flyer say?"
Miller squinted at the tiny print.
"It invites us to follow the treasure trail."
Murphy shuddered.
"Jeez, is it for a casino or a brothel?"
"A casino. Declan's on the strip, about a block down from the arch. They have this stupid path of gold coins printed on the carpet. You follow it all the way to the back through a gauntlet of slot machines, and you get a free spin on a giant slot machine. Then you have to walk out through the gauntlet of slot machines, which is how they get you."
"What do you mean that's how they get you?"
"It's obvious, isn't it? They want you to lose all your money on their slot machines, so they make you walk through the whole casino."
"To play a giant slot machine?"
"Yeah! I don't see why this is so hard for you to understand."
"Oh, I understand," Agent Murphy said. "I just don't think that luring you in to play slot machines by promising to let you play a slot machine is as underhanded as you seem to think it is."
Agent Miller flapped his hand dismissively at his partner.
"Oh, pipe down. You just don't understand how gambling works."
"Not the same way you do, obviously. You should knock it off anyway. The director's not going to be happy if she finds out you're spending a lot of time at the casinos, Miller."
"What I do on my own time is none of her damn business, Murph."
"It'll reflect poorly on the task force."
"This is Reno. It's the biggest little eyesore in the world. The place you go when Vegas is too upmarket. Just being here reflects badly on the task force."
"But the scenery's beautiful."
"Yes. The area around Reno that isn't actually Reno itself is lovely."
Murphy said,
"It's better than riding a desk." "I don't want to go back to the desk, Miller. If we screw up and get yanked from this task force, that's right where we'll be."
"If we're lucky. The Treasury Department probably won't want us back, after both Jimmy Sadler and Todd Douglas escaped. If they boot us from this task force, we're probably out of law enforcement for good."
"Yeah. All the more reason not to screw up, okay?"
Miller nodded.
"Yeah, yeah. You're right, Murph. I just get a little... Crap! There he is!"
"Where?"
"Coming out of the building!"
"Which building?"
"What? The luxury... Shut up! Sadler's on the move!"
Murphy leaned forward.
"We'll see.
Across the street, a thin gentleman in his mid-50s, with a neat iron-gray goatee, wearing black slacks, a black polo shirt, and a checked sport coat, walked out of the front entrance of the luxurious Rothschild building where he lived. Both agents knew he was James Sadler, a.k.a. Jimmy, a.k.a. Merlin. Sadler buttoned the top button of his sport coat, as if that would do anything to ward off the chill. He stood on the sidewalk, breathing deeply. After several breaths, he put his arms out wide and spun around twice in a cartoonish show of enjoying his freedom.
"Bastard!" Miller snarled. "Why the director won't let us move in and take him, I don't know."
"It's because she figures he'll just escape again."
"Thanks for that, Murph."
"Well, you said you didn't know."
Yeah, I get it."
Miller jerked his head from side to side, checking the car's blind spots. He brought his hand up to the keys, which were hanging from the ignition. Murphy said,
"You know he's just messing with us, Miller."
"He doesn't know we're here."
"You don't believe that."
"I might."
"Miller, 2 hours ago he came down, walked to his car. You tried to start the car."
Miller gave Murphy a look that stopped him mid-sentence. Murphy put up his hands and continued in a softer tone.
"We both know what happened. Then he acted like he'd forgotten something and went back inside. An hour later, he came down and got in his car. The same thing happened again, and he got out of his car with some mail he'd left on the passenger seat and went back inside."
"Yeah, and now he's gonna go somewhere. Look, he's getting in his car."
Across the street, Jimmy walked to the parking lot and slid into his glossy black two-door Lexus. Murphy closed his laptop and started to open his door.
"At least let me check the back."
Miller grabbed Murphy by the arm, stopping him.
"No time and no need. I've kept an eye on the rear view and nobody snuck up behind us, I'm sure of it."
"Miller, we both know he can—"
"Will you stop talking? He's not onto us. Nobody snuck up behind the car. And look, he started his engine. I told you this time he was on the move."
The black Lexus moved forward and turned to the right, pulling out of its parking space. Miller said,
"Here we go."
He turned the key and started the car. The engine rumbled to life, purred for about 3 seconds, then coughed, sputtered, and died. The fan blew full blast and a chime sounded from deep inside the dash, but no sound came from the engine. Miller shouted,
"Damn it!"
Across the street, Jimmy put the Lexus in reverse, pulled back into the parking space he'd just left, and killed the engine. Miller again shouted,
"Damn it!"
Murphy said, "Just shut the car off, Miller."
Miller gritted his teeth so hard that it felt like his incisors might crack. But he turned the key, silencing the chime and the fan. They heard people laughing behind the car. Murphy asked,
"Shall I go get it?"
Miller turned and looked at him silently.
"Yeah,"
Murphy said,
"I'll go get it. You stay here."
Miller continued to stare as his partner got out of the car, then looked back at Jimmy sitting in his Lexus across the street. He heard the laughter continue, and the voice of the young man with the flyers say,
"Hey, man! It looks like you fell for the banana in the tailpipe!"
The laughter from the tourists grew louder.
"Yeah,
Murphy laughed insincerely.
"Looks like it."
Some unseen woman said,
"Classic. Banana in the tailpipe. It stops at the exhaust and makes the car stall."
"Yeah," Murphy interrupted. "We all know why. Everyone saw the movie."
A young man said,
"I'd heard it doesn't work, though. Saw it on TV where they tried and couldn't get it to work."
Murphy said,
"Yeah, well, I suppose this must be some kind of magic banana, then."
Murphy continued to make small talk about bananas, tailpipes, and Beverly Hills Cop, but Miller tuned it all out, watching Jimmy get out of his Lexus, looking irritatingly pleased with himself, almost skipping back into the luxurious Rothschild building. Murphy got back in the car, clutching a dirty, soot-smeared banana. Miller said,
"I watched. I watched the rearview mirror. I watched both side-view mirrors. There's no way anyone snuck up behind the car and stuck a banana in our tailpipe without me seeing."
"Miller, it's Jimmy. We've seen him teleport. We know he can make things appear and disappear out of thin air. He clearly used his powers to put the banana in our tailpipe, what, 3 times now? I mean, it shouldn't even work. That's a dead giveaway."
Across the street, Jimmy continued his stroll away from the parking lot, exchanged some friendly banter with the doorman, then disappeared into the building, briefly turning his head to let his vision sweep across the street. He cast a surreptitious look at Miller and Murphy, and let them see the smile on his face.
"Why?"
Miller asked.
"Why would he go to the trouble to keep putting bananas in our tailpipe when he knows it shouldn't work?"
"It really bugs you, doesn't it?"
"Yeah!"
"Well, there's your answer. The end goal is to bother us and inconvenience us, and we get a chorus of tourists laughing and wanting to talk to us about the banana in the tailpipe, and how it's not actually supposed to work. He knows us. Let's be honest, he knows you well enough to know that that'll drive you crazy."
"But still, why? If he knows we're watching him, why not just ditch us?"
Murphy shrugged, reopening his laptop.
"I figure two reasons. One is that he's not worried about us, and the other is that he's a jerk."
Miller thought for a long moment.
"I can't argue with that."
4. Martin, Philip, Britt the Younger, and Gwen flew in a lopsided V formation, like a flying checkmark. Even though wind resistance meant little to the wizards in terms of energy expenditure, less wind made for a more pleasant flight, and taking a cue from geese made flying at high speed more fun for everyone, except whoever was flying in the lead. In this case, Martin. They came in low over the forest canopy, then slowed as they reached a zone of dead trees and scorched earth that thinned into a clearing by the base of a granite cliff. Martin calibrated his speed and angle of descent in such a way as to drift into a cave about 20 feet up the cliff wall, shaped like a screaming skull. He decelerated smoothly, landing at the back of the cave at Gary's doorstep. Or at least he would have if he hadn't been forced to come to an abrupt stop. In the dim light inside the cave, he saw a person sitting, slumped, with his back to Gary's door. Britt, Gwen, and Philip nearly crashed into Martin's back, but they all managed to stop with great effort and much muttered cursing. Martin peered through the dim light at the figure on the doorstep.
"Who is that?"
he asked. He inhaled tentatively through his nose.
"Hilbert? What are you doing here?"
"Learning the mystic arts from my master."
Hubert, the town of Ledchurch's apprentice dung sifter, said. From inside the door, Gary shouted,
"No, you're not!"
Gwen asked,
"Who's your master?"
Hubert jerked a filthy thumb back over his shoulder toward the door.
"The necromancer, that fearsome mystical warrior known to man and demon alike as Gary."
"No!"
Gary shouted from inside.
"I'm not teaching you squat!"
Philip crouched down to address Hubert closer to his own eye level, and in the hopes that the warm, fragrant air coming off of Hubert was rising.
"Hubert, what is it you think Gary is teaching you by refusing to let you into his house and insisting that he won't teach you anything?"
"He's teaching me the importance of humility and patience."
"So, things that Gary himself doesn't know,"
Gwen muttered. Britt the Younger shouted through the door,
"That means he figures you're gonna let him inside eventually."
"I'm not!"
Gary shouted.
Martin asked,
"Do you plan to let us in?"
Gary opened the door. Hubert's eyes grew wide with horror and fascination at the sight of him, with his black robe and hat, his skeletal prosthetic leg, and his face hidden by a full gas mask. Gary pointed down at Hubert.
"You! Get out of my friend's way!"
"Yes, master!"
Hubert scuttled like a crab away from the door, then kneeled, looking up with reverence. Gary kept his eyes on Hubert as he held the door open wide. Once all of the wizards had entered, Hubert said,
"I'll wait to do your bidding, master."
Gary snarled,
"Good. Then go home."
"Already done, master. My home is by your side."
Gary slammed the door shut.
"How'd that happen?"
Martin asked as they all walked through the ceremonial antechamber where Gary performed magic for any locals who came to him for help. They pass through the circular cave, past the many torches and the stone altar holding an immense, ancient-looking, leather-bound book, which concealed a mid-90s trackball power book. Gary took off his gas mask and led his guests to the door at the far side of the chamber.
I don't know. He found that old Gene Simmons action figure of mine and thought it gave him magical powers. I guess he got the bug. Now he wants more.
Gary opened the far door, revealing his actual home, a haven of off-white walls and beige carpets. It was clear that he had tried very hard to make his place look nice, but had no idea what nice looked like. It was a home that was fast and easy to tidy up, but would be next to impossible to actually clean. Gary asked,
"So why'd you fly in? You said you were gonna teleport."
Gwen walked to one of Gary's two giant brown recliners. They'd come as a set, with a matching giant brown sectional, and were large enough to hold two well-acquainted people if they each scooched far to the sides. Gwen looked Martin in the eye and planted herself directly in the middle of the seat. The chairs and the couch faced a faux wood grain rectangle of pressboard slabs, holding multiple electronic devices tethered to a massive Sony Trinitron from the days when having a large flat-screen TV meant owning a huge heavy box containing a massive glass vacuum tube, the 32-inch front of which was flat. The TV was tethered to a series of dusty black boxes by a series of tangled black cords. Once settled, Gwen pointed to the corner of the main room where people materialized when they used Gary's pre-programmed teleportation algorithm. In it sat a plastic backyard kiddie pool full of some gray liquid.
"What's that, Gary?"
A guilty smile crept across Gary's face.
"Wet concrete. I've enchanted it to harden as soon as any solid object appears in it."
"Any solid object? Like our feet?"
"That's one example."
"Yeah, well, that's why we didn't teleport in."
"Fair enough. I got Jeff and Roy anyway. They should be back any minute. Chiseling their feet free shouldn't take long. And Tyler hasn't arrived yet. Should I remove the concrete?"
Martin said,
"You know what we're gonna say."
"Of course not,"
Gary asked.
"Of course not,"
Martin said. He opened the refrigerator and found it fully stocked, with beverages and condiments. He grabbed a beer, closed the door, twisted off the bottle cap, and threw it into the garbage can, which was full of empty beverage and condiment containers. A bluish light filled the room. Everyone's attention turned as Jeff and Roy materialized, hovering 2 feet above the kiddie pool full of concrete. Their shoes had a dirty gray cast about them, and the hems of their robes hung straight down, still weighted by small chunks of concrete stuck to the fabric. On Jeff's wool robe, the gray stains looked incongruous. Roy, on the other hand, wore a trench coat and a modified fedora for his wizard uniform, so the cement stains looked appropriate and gave the impression he'd narrowly escaped angry mobsters.
"Was the concrete hard to get rid of?"
Gary asked, obviously hoping the answer was yes. Jeff said,
"It wasn't as unpleasant for us to remove as it will be for you when you find where we put it."
He and Roy floated to the edge of the waiting pool, dropped to the floor, and walked to empty spots on the sectional, leaving dusty gray footprints.
Guys, do you think I could get you to take off your shoes and put them by the door?"
Gary asked.
Roy growled, "No, I don't. You got a lot of nerve complaining, embedding our shoes in concrete, then complaining that we're tracking concrete into your house."
Gwen said,
"He's got a point, Gary. Besides, there's not really much anyone can do to mess this place up."
Gary said,
"Thank you."
Jeff shook his head.
"Gary, that was an insult."
Gwen said, "No, Gary, I'm sorry. I didn't mean anything by that. Sure, your place is a bit rough around the edges, and through the middle. Really, it's one homogeneous slab of roughness, but it suits you."
"Thank you,"
Gary said.
"That was also an insult," Jeff said.
Roy touched down and walked to the dining area, which housed a matching set of chairs and a glass-top table, of the kind meant to grace a retiree's patio, complete with a hole in the table's center designed to accommodate a large umbrella. He nodded to Martin and Philip, but removed his hat to the ladies.
"Hello, Gwen. Hello, Britt. It's good to see you again today."
This confused Britt.
"I'm sorry?"
Jeff said, No, Roy, that was Britt the Elder who came over. This is Britt the Younger. Roy shrugged.
Still, they're the same person, so we have seen her twice today.
Jeff gritted his teeth. It would kill you to be wrong, wouldn't it?
I'll let you know if it ever happens. Why did Britt the Elder go see you?
Philip asked. She had some technical questions, Jeff said. Stuff about the dragons and what I learned trying to manipulate living things in the shell.
Mostly not to do it,
Gwen asked. Exactly, Jeff said.
That answer didn't make her happy,
Roy said.
Poor thing. She seemed pretty strung out. Not just tired, but upset, too. I'm thinking maybe I should go over to her place and see if she needs some support.
What kind of support? Philip asked. Roy shrugged.
You know, comforting.
I don't know if that's a good idea.
And I don't know if that's any of your business, Philip. I mean, you always say that you don't believe she and Britt the Younger here are the same person, so the way I see it, dating Britt the Younger gives you no say in Britt the Elder's affairs.
It doesn't actually give him any say over my affairs either, Britt the Younger said.
Right,
Roy agreed.
And if you're wrong, and they are the same person, by the time she becomes Britt the Elder, you don't seem to be in the picture anymore.
But I am, Britt the Younger said, because I am convinced that we are the same person, and I say, leave her alone. If she needs help, let her ask for it. I hate people meddling in my affairs, so when it comes to hers, which are going to be mine eventually, I say we all stay out of it.
Martin asked,
But by making that decision for her, aren't you meddling in her affairs?
The affairs are either hers, mine, or both, depending on how you look at it. But none of it's any of your business, so drop it. Okay?
At that moment, the entire group heard a quiet splash and a loud burst of energetic swearing. They all turned to see Tyler, the last wizard to arrive and the only African-American man in medieval England, standing ankle-deep in the kiddie pool full of hardened concrete. He tried to pull his staff free, straining mightily, but it would not budge. He continued swearing, first at the concrete, then at Gary, then at himself for trusting Gary and not anticipating the concrete. Tyler teleported away, leaving the empty kiddie pool behind. Almost immediately he rematerialized, minus the large disc of concrete that had been fixed to his feet.
So he got you,
Philip said.
Don't let it ruin your night.
I'm mad at myself for not seeing it coming,
Tyler said.
But I'm much, much madder at Gary for being such a turd.
Tyler turned his attention to Gary.
Okay, we're all here. Three of us are angry. Why don't we just get started?
Gary stood and held his arms out wide.
Yes, let us begin. Welcome, one and all, to our weekly movie night. As the host, I get to pick the movie. This week's selection is Blade Runner.
Philip said,
Haven't we all seen that?
Roy said,
I haven't. What's it about? A guy who runs with scissors?
No,
Gary said.
And while the rest of you have seen it, which version have you seen? The original, with the narration that the producers made the director put in, or the later version where the director took the narration out?
And added a scene to completely change the whole point of the movie,
Tyler said.
Or the even later version, when they restored the film so it would look good on DVD.
Or the version after that, Martin said, where they remastered it again and redid a few of the scenes to look better at high resolution.
Or, Jeff asked, the even later one where the original producers put the narration back in, huh? Britt wrinkled her nose like she smelled something bad.
They did that?
Jeff shrugged. They do eventually. Ridley Scott released his director's cut to make Blade Runner fit his original vision. The producers released their cut to make it fit their original vision, which was for the film to earn them as much profit as possible.
Gary said, There's no reason we only have to watch one version. I was thinking we could watch all of them. It's a marathon.
Roy said,
Who'd want to do that? Watch the same movie three times, looking for minor differences? Like it's a puzzle and highlights for kids? This sounds worse than when Martin made us sit through that four-hour version of Dune.
Nothing could be worse than that, Gwen muttered.
Martin laughed. Gary,
Remind me next time it's my turn to host movie night to get the 3-part basic cable Dune miniseries.
Gary said,
only if I don't have to attend.
5. Britt the Elder sat uneasily in a chair made from enough welded square-tube steel to be indestructible, which was covered with just enough foam padding and vinyl upholstery to not quite be comfortable. She sat in an office that was instantly recognizable as the habitat of an executive-level